Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levone, bringing you an hour of horror. Later on, master storyteller Nelson Olmsted tells us two tales on Sleep No More. But right now, a visit to Old Witch Nancy for The Witch's Tale. This episode first heard on September 7th, 1934, called The Puzzle.
The Witch's Tale. Fascination for the eerie. Weird, blood-chilling tales told by old Nancy, the witch of Salem, and Satan, her wise black cat. They are waiting for you. Now.
I'm not a 17-year-old I be today. Yes, sir, 117-year-old. Well, Satan, let's get down to our yarn spinning. Come on, have doused out them lights so we'll have it nice and dark. And draw up to the fire so that you can gaze into the embers. You'll need a fire to warm your blood. You listen to this pretty tale. You'll gaze into the embers deep, and soon you'll see a big railway depot in the town of London, England. You hear them funny little engines the English people got? Soon you'll see a funny little coach like the ones they pulled behind them. And soon you'll hear our yarn about the puzzle. The puzzle!
Everything's stowed away, sir, and the guard has assured me, Mr. Holmes, that you'll have the compartment to yourself, sir, all the way to here.
Oh, that's just bully. This chauffeur of yours is a born fixer, Cecil.
Yes.
You know, since I first came to England, I've learned to appreciate the privacy of your railway compartment system.
And today, I take it, you're especially appreciative. The chap who's on his way to meet the parents of his prospective bride for the first time will want privacy for the examination of his conscience.
Our Julia hasn't much respect for her stepmother's opinion. I really have only my future father-in-law to worry about. You know, it's funny you haven't heard of him. I'm told he's one of the most successful attorneys in London.
Well, his name's vaguely familiar. Omeroyd. Omeroyd?
Yes, Theodore Omeroyd. Firm of Omeroyd and Hardy.
Oh, is he any other claim to fame?
Well, Julia tells me he's a puzzle expert.
Puzzle expert?
Yeah, you know, puzzles are his hobby.
Oh, you mean he solves those crossword thingy-bobs and plays with those wire and steel, what do you call them, huh?
Yeah, that's it.
My word.
Well, let's be walking towards the train, Cecil.
Very well. Lead the way, Colin.
Yes, sir.
I'm dash sorry you won't stand to the next train, Willis. We've only had these few minutes together since you arrived from Dover.
Oh, I can't stay over. It was awfully good of you to meet me here for this brief get-together.
Oh, I had to hear more of the wonderful girl you've been writing me about. You met her in France?
Yeah.
Oh, deucedly romantic. You from USA and she from England go to France to find each other.
Well, the poet says, two shall be born a whole wide world apart.
Oh, the man is in love. He's even quoting poetry.
Yeah, I guess I have got it pretty badly.
Well, here's the train. Nearly ready to start.
I'm very anxious to rejoin her.
Why did she leave Paris just ahead of you?
Our stupid convention. Julia's chaperone couldn't get away, and she maintained it wasn't proper for engaged people to travel unaccompanied.
Oh, I say.
I'm sorry I didn't tell the old dodo to go jump on the Seine with a Victorian notion. Julia shouldn't have made that trip alone. She was too badly upset.
Oh, upset?
Well, you see, she was called home by a telegram from her stepmother. It was one of those vaguely worded, "Your presence is required immediately" messages. Makes you imagine all sorts of calamities. Well, Julia decided something had happened to her father. She's very devoted to him. Well, to ease her mind, I called her home by long distance and was told there was no illness there or accident or death. They just wouldn't explain the reason for her summons, though. Well, that only made it more urgent. So when I put her on the train, she was still greatly worried.
Sounds rather mysterious.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, but whatever the trouble is, it can be very serious. Illness, death, and accident have been definitely ruled out.
All aboard!
That means me. Which is my compartment, Collins?
Right here, sir. Number 3. This is my gentleman guard, which you promised to take care of.
Oh, yes. Sit right in, sir. You'll be alone in the compartment all the way, sir. I've arranged for that.
Oh, that's fine, guard. Here, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, now, in perfect solitude, you can prepare yourself to meet your future father-in-law. Too bad you haven't made a study of puzzles, Willis. Then it accepts you as a kindred soul. Yes.
I suppose I'll have to give that subject a lot of serious thought.
Yes.
Toodaloo, old thing.
So long, Thistle. Goodbye, Colin.
Bye, Mr. Collins. Best of luck, Willis.
Thanks. I may need it. Well, I'm off.
Chip, your friend.
What? Oh, I beg your pardon. But where? You weren't in this compartment a moment ago. How did you...
A puzzle, isn't it? You really must give serious thought to the subject of puzzles, Mr. Holmes.
You know my name?
Very well. Now, permit me to tell you mine. I am Theodore Omeroy.
You're Julia's father.
Yes.
Oh, of course. Now I recognize you from the photograph. Oh, this is a pleasure, sir.
Excuse me if I don't shake hands. I've recently met with a serious injury.
An injury?
A rather painful one. Although, as you see, I wear no bandages.
Was it merely your hand that was injured, sir? You were very pale, as though you had experienced a serious illness. You have been ill. Oh, that's the reason Mrs. Omeroy sent that telegram to Julia.
It was because of me that telegram was sent. But let's not talk about that now, if you don't mind. I prefer a more pleasant subject. I'm very glad to know you, my boy.
And I to know you, sir. But how did you know me?
Well, that's an easy puzzle to solve. According to my daughter's letters, there can be but one Willis Holmes.
Well, I hope I can convince you of that, sir. But the guard said I was to be alone in this compartment. And when he closed the door, I was alone. How on earth did you...
I came aboard from the other side.
The other side?
Yes. You see how simple puzzles are when one is told the answers. My gracious. Here I've been talking of puzzles for a solid hour. I hope you'll forgive me. You see, to me, all life is an endless succession of intricate problems, which the successful man must solve for himself, and which the good man, the man who loves, must solve for others. I wanted you to know my philosophy, and now I won't bore you any longer.
Oh, you haven't bored me at all, sir. I've been intensely interested.
Here's your ticket, please, sir.
Oh, good Lord, conductor, not again.
Sorry to bother you, but it's rules, sir. All right, sir, and thank you.
Well, one puzzle I'd wish you'd solve for me, Mr. Omeroyd, is why that conductor never asked to see your ticket. He's looked at mine four times.
I ride free, my boy.
Are you a stockholder of this road?
No. I'm well acquainted with the chairman of its governing board, though. Mr. Travers. My firm handles his legal business. The last time I rode this train, I carried £50,000 of his money in currency.
In currency?
£1,000 notes.
That's rather dangerous, isn't it? Men have been murdered for a great deal less.
It is a dangerous business. But when one is accustomed to handling large sums, one grows careless. Ah, we're pulling into Whittam. I leave you here, my boy.
Oh, aren't you going home to Fearing, Mr. Omeroyd?
Not now. First, I must return to Whittam. That's where Mr. Trezor has his residence. You won't see me again until tomorrow. In the meantime, will you give a little serious thought to the subject of puzzles?
I certainly shall, Mr. Omeroyd. But I value your expert opinion as to where and how I'd best begin.
Circumstances will indicate your course of thought.
Whittam! Whittam! All right for Whittam!
Oh, it's been wonderful meeting you like this. I was a little worried at the prospect of formally asking you to accept me as your son-in-law.
I accept you gladly. You'll look after Julia, won't you?
I love your daughter very dearly.
And you will remember that he who loves must solve life's problems for others. I must leave you until tomorrow. Again, excuse my hand. The injury I mentioned. Dear me, where's my cigarette case?
Cigarette case? I haven't seen you use one, sir.
I'm sure I had it with me. I must have dropped it here.
Oh, well, I'll look for it. And
just take care of it if you find it. You and Julia, take good care of it.
All right, I found it already. Falling behind these cushions.
Mr. Romroy? Oh, we're guard.
Guard!
I tell you, sir.
Which way did the gentleman go who was with me in this compartment?
A gentleman with you? In this compartment, sir?
Of course. He just stepped out. He was standing right beside the door. You must have seen him.
This door's been closer until you opened it yourself just now. You've been alone in this compartment all the way from London.
The gentleman we've been expecting has arrived, Mrs. Romroy. Mr. Willis Holmes.
But show him in, Barker, and then inform Miss Julia that he's here.
Well, I'll fetch Julia, if you wish, Mrs. Romroy.
Well, perhaps you'd better, Mr. Tom.
You're going to let Julia tell the young man our bad news?
Naturally. He's had a fine husband at present.
You think he'll break the engagement when he learns?
Well, now, what would you do if you were in his place, Mr. Hardy?
Mr. Willis Holmes.
Oh, well, come in, Mr. Holmes. Julia will be here directly. I am Mrs. Omeroyd.
Oh, this is a great pleasure, Mrs. Omeroyd. Julia has told me so many things about you, I feel I already know you.
I'll wager she never told you many nice things about me.
Agatha, control yourself. Really, I...
Allow me to present these gentlemen. Mr. Hardy and Mr. Holmes.
How do you do, young man?
Mr. Hardy, you're Mr. Omeroyd's partner, I imagine.
I'm the junior member of Omeroyd and Hardy.
And this is Mr. Justice Rowley, Mr. Holmes.
How do you do, Justice Rowley?
Justice is a difficult title, isn't it? In America, I believe you would call me judge, although I'm merely a provincial justice of the peace.
Julia, be down directly, Mrs. Omeroy. Excuse me.
Oh, this is Mr. Toms, Mr. Holmes.
How do you do?
Pleasure, old chap. Charms, all that, you know.
Mr. Toms is my husband's personal secretary. Won't you all sit down?
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Holmes looks rather uncomfortable. I don't imagine he expected to encounter such a large gathering.
Of course he's uncomfortable. Poor chap. Comes to pay a visit to Miss Ormeroyd's family and finds the house party in full swing about the place.
House party?
Agatha, you must control yourself. I don't understand.
Well, there's nothing you need to understand, old man. Not now. I'm told you're an American. How do you like England?
I have learned to like it very much, Mr. Toms, with some exceptions.
Sure, what are they?
Well, one is the type of guard employed on your railway train.
You don't approve of our railway guards.
Well, I've just had a very ridiculous experience with one. A chap either afflicted with blindness or a very faulty sense of humor. It's a rather silly story, but if you care to hear it, I...
Willis! Oh,
Julia!
Oh, Willis, I'm so glad you're here. So glad.
Darling, what's the matter?
Julia, control yourself.
Things are already bad enough, Julia. If you wish to tell him now of our disgrace, at least wait until I can leave the room.
Disgrace? What do you mean? Julia, dear, I talked to your father on the train an hour ago, and he didn't mention any trouble here.
What did you say?
You talked to my father?
Yes, we traveled from London together as far as Whippham.
I don't believe it. He wouldn't have dared.
Quiet. Willis, you're sure it was my father?
Of course I am. Why, he...
Did he say where he was going when he left you? Did he say when he'd be home?
Yes. He was on his way to a place called Whippham. And he said he'd be home tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh, thank God. I knew everything would come out all right. The father would come back and explain.
Mr. Holmes was mistaken in the man he talked to.
Yes, Ormeroyd couldn't have traveled on that train as far as Whittam.
The police would have arrested him before he got aboard.
Police?
Yes, and if the Bobby's missed him, every guard and conductor on that road has his description.
Well, I haven't the faintest idea what any of you are talking about. Though I've never met him before, I've seen his photograph, and I was neither mistaken nor the dupe of an imposter.
What did he think of you, Willis, besides the other things you've told us?
Well, he talked mostly about puzzles.
What, Father?
Won't someone please explain to me what all this is about?
Perhaps that's my painful duty, Mr. Holmes. Through powerful influence, we've thus far kept the story from the newspapers. But 2 weeks ago, Theodore Ormeroy disappeared with £50,000 belonging to a client of our firm, a Mr. Travis of Whittam. Indication has been found that Mr. Ormeroyd met with accident or foul play.
Well, the inference is obvious.
And he left me, his wife, to face the scandal.
Travis is the man he was on his way to see today.
You have been imposed upon.
No, it was Father. I know he talked with Father.
So do I. And I hardly think, Justice Lawley, that a practical joker would have possessed this cigarette case with Mr. Ormeroyd's monogram upon it.
Father!
By Jove!
It's Ormeroyd!
Where did you get that silver case?
From the compartment where he left it, as he alighted from the train.
Everything will be explained. He said he'd be home tomorrow. Willis, he said he'd be home tomorrow.
Yes.
Maybe that's him now. Maybe it...
Don't be ridiculous. Your father wouldn't ring his own doorbell.
If he comes here, the police will bring him as a prisoner.
Come in.
A police officer is here to see you, Mrs. Ormeroyd.
Oh, they've arrested him.
If they have, dear, they'll soon let him go.
Show the officer in.
Yes, ma'am.
I asked to come in on you like this, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Justice Rowley.
What is it, man? Speak up.
It's bad news, sir. The constables at Whittam have found Mr. Ormeroyd, sir.
They've arrested him?
No, ma'am. They found him dead.
What?
Dead? Yes, ma'am. The doctors say he's been dead 2 weeks.
Dead 2 weeks?
Yes, sir. They'll bring his body home first thing tomorrow.
His body home tomorrow? Merciful God, what was it that rode with me in that compartment?
But my dear Holmes, it's been established conclusively that my partner was lying dead in that pit where they found him, the very time you insist he was with you on that train.
Nevertheless, he, or his spirit, was with me, as I said. Oh, I know it sounds mad, impossible. I've always laughed at the tales of the supernatural, just as you're laughing at me now. But I saw Mr. Ormeroyd. He talked with me an hour, I tell you. Julia, you at least believe me.
I don't know. It's all so horrible.
It's too fantastic for anyone to believe.
And even if you did see a ghost, Holmes, what purpose did the thing accomplish?
Oh, none, I guess. Still, I feel it had a purpose in coming to me. One I can't grasp.
Seems to me the traditional storybook phantom would have been of more practical service, Mr. Holmes. They always accuse their murderer.
And such an accusation seems the only means by which the killer can ever be brought to justice. We know now that poor Ormeroyd was struck down for that large sum of money he carried. But other than that obvious conclusion, we of the law haven't found a single clue.
The ghost should have known his murderer had left no trail. But instead of dropping a helpful hint, Mr. Holmes says his spectre merely talked of puzzles.
That would have been my father's way.
Julia, you're not going to become a champion of this young man's mad delusion.
If your father's spirit could return to Earth, he'd appear to you or to me, rather than to Zenfield's fiancée, whom he'd never met in life. Father always said, the man who loves solves the problems of others.
That's what he said to me.
Oh, this is asinine.
You've had a dream, my boy. Better forget it.
No, for it wasn't a dream. It was real. And it had a purpose. Only I'm too blind to see it. I didn't dream this silver cigarette case. Isn't that tangible proof?
I'm afraid that now I must shatter your illusions. I was advised today that the coach in which you traveled from London, by a strange coincidence, was the one in which 2 weeks before Mr. Ormeroy took his fatal journey to Witham. Lying in idleness, the car had not been cleaned carefully. So you found that case where the unfortunate man had mislaid it.
Then he returned to put it in my hands. That was his purpose. I see it now. Somehow in this cigarette case is the solution of the puzzle.
Willis! Since you regard the case in that light, perhaps you'd better give it into my keeping as a possible clue for the police.
No, I give it to no one. For now I know a guilty conscience has been keener than my wits.
A guilty conscience? Are you accusing...
I accuse no one yet.
Oh, what do you mean?
I mean that now everyone in this room, at different times with a different excuse, has asked me for this case. Let me close this door, Julia. We can then talk in private.
Willis, what did you mean by the insinuation you made a moment ago?
Exactly what I said. That perhaps a guilty conscience has been keener than my wits. The killer of your father wants this cigarette case because he has some reason to be afraid of it. Your father's partner, Hardy, came to me 2 days ago and requested it as a keepsake. The day before that, Tom's made the same request. Yesterday, your stepmother asked for it, and now Rowley would like to have it. Fortunately, some instinct made me refuse to give it up, even before I guessed it was the solution of my ghastly puzzle.
But your suspicions are terrible. In spite of the frightful way they'd acted, those people were my father's friends.
Your father was killed for a sum of money, but only his friends or his confidants. You, he carried on his person. If I can only solve the puzzle of the cigarette case, I'll learn which one is guilty. His last words to me were, take care of it. You and Julia, take good care of it.
Your theory must be right. With father, everything was the foundation of a puzzle. You think there may be a secret compartment in the case?
Yes, in which something is hidden. The metal is unnaturally thick on the sides and heavily embossed. There may be a shallow cavity between.
Look for a spring or lever hidden in that screwwork.
Here I am.
Feel around the edges. Maybe something slides.
That's it. That's it. A sliding edge. Look, I found it. Look.
The metal slides are hollow.
And there's a folded paper in the recess.
What's written on it?
It's dated June the 12th. The day your father went to Whittam with that £50,000. It says, on the understanding that if I have not left England by tomorrow noon, Theodore Omeroyd, to whom I give this writing, will make its contents public. I hereby confess...
Confess? To what?
Oh, that can wait. Let me see whose name is signed here.
Ah! The light!
Who turned out those lights?
Someone with us in this room.
Arr, let me go! Let me go! No, you won't get this paper!
Of course, he's coming to now.
Nothing wrong but a bump on the head.
What happened in this room before you screamed, Julia?
Yes, for heaven's sake, what happened?
One of you know what happened as well as I do. For one of you came in that door while our backs were turned. One of you turned out these lights. One of you struck Willis, then seized the paper we'd found and ran. And the one of you who did it is the one who killed my father.
The girl's insane.
Mad.
How dare you accuse one of us?
Your father's friend.
Because one of you is guilty.
Oh, not wrong.
Julia.
Oh, Willis, darling. Are you all right now?
Yes. Whoever hit me got away with the paper before we saw the name of Pius.
Yes, they got away.
I failed your father.
When you failed, I may succeed. If my father came to you, perhaps he'll come again to me.
What are you doing, Julia?
I have locked the one door leading from this room.
Why?
Julia, what have you done?
She turned off the lights.
Stop that!
Turn on those lights.
Oh, I say, you're going too far.
No. Only one of you needs here the dark and this locked room. But if my prayer is answered, that one must face the man he killed. Oh, Lord, I pray thee, send my father from the dead to bring justice.
Open the door. Turn on these lights.
Are you afraid?
No, I didn't kill him.
Father, come to me from the grave.
This nonsense has gone far enough.
Are you afraid?
I have no cause to be afraid.
Lord, send my father here to bring justice.
Oh, I'm not going to be made a fool of by a sick-brained girl. Think what you like. I'm going to leave this room.
Yes, we'll all leave.
Open that door. Come on, quickly.
Open the door.
Stay where you are.
That voice, Mr. Omeroyd.
Theodore.
Good kitty.
Father, God has let you answer.
Some puzzles are too difficult for men to solve alone.
Let me out of this room!
Oh, don't be afraid. That's not Omeroyd's voice. You see, Holmes and the girl are playing a trick upon us in the darkness.
No. There's something awful here.
A hazy light is growing in this room.
Omeroyd's face is taking shape there.
Keep him away. Keep him away.
You help us with our puzzle, Rowley.
I'll do anything you say. Only don't come near me with your cold, dead hands. Keep away. I'll tell them. I'll confess. But keep away.
Rowley.
You.
Yes, I killed him.
Tell them why.
He learned I'd taken bribes. He made me sign a confession that would send me to prison if I stayed in England.
I waited for him on the road to Travis' house. I didn't know about the money he had with him. All I wanted was the paper that I didn't find. The paper in that cigarette case that I never found until tonight. Here it is. Use it to send me to the gallows. But don't come near me with your cold, dead hands. Don't come near me with your cold, dead hands.
I have the paper. His confession.
You and Tom's hold on to him. I'll phone for the police.
Oh, I won't try to get away. There's no escape from the dead. The dead.
Father! Father! Willis! His form is fading.
Goodbye, Julia. My task is over. We will not meet here again.
Father!
Julia, dear.
Take care of her, my boy. And remember, he who loves must solve the puzzles of life for others.
Of that meeting. You folks come see us next time I had a birthday.
The Witch's Tale, on Tuned to Yesterday from September 7th, 1934, a syndicated broadcast. You're listening to An Hour of Horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for the Sleep No More series with Nelson Olmsted telling us two tales designed to keep us on the edge of our seat from January 9th, 1957. The first one is called The Waxwork, which was adapted on the Suspense radio series at one time. Also, The Man and the Snake, penned by Ambrose Bierce. He was an American author best known for his story An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which was adapted on Suspense three times, and also the Escape series. We hear his story, The Man and the Snake, as part of this broadcast next on NBC from January 9, 1957.
This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Once in a while in my reading, I come across a short story so different, so powerful, so well written, that I can't forget it. Our first story tonight is a case in point, written by one of England's masters of the short story art, A.M. Burridge. It's about a man who went out of his way to scare himself to the absolute limit. Listen while I tell you about The Waxwork. While the uniformed attendants of Merrimer's Waxworks were ushering the last stragglers through the great glass-paneled double doors, the manager sat in his office interviewing Raymond Hewson, a journalist. The manager was speaking.
Yes, Mr. Hewson. It used to be said years ago that Madame Tussauds would give a man £100 for sleeping alone in the Chamber of Horrors. I hope you don't think that we've made any such offer, Mr. Hewson. However, if you get your story printed in the Morning Echo, there will be a £5 note waiting for you here when you care to come and call for it.
Well, that's satisfactory.
Fine. But, first of all, it's no small ordeal that you're proposing to undertake. I'd like to be quite sure about you, and I'd like you to be quite sure about yourself. I own I shouldn't care to take it on. I've seen those wax figures dressed and undressed, and I know all about the process of their manufacture. I can walk about in their company downstairs as unmoved as if I were walking among so many Skittles. But I should hate having to sleep down there among them, alone. Well, why? I don't know. There isn't any reason. I don't believe in ghosts. It's just that I couldn't sit alone among them at night with their seeming to stare at me the way they do. No, the whole atmosphere of the place is unpleasant. And if you are susceptible to atmosphere, I warn you that you are in for a very uncomfortable night.
Hewson had known that from the moment when the idea had first occurred to him. His soul sickened at the prospect, even while he smiled casually upon the manager. But he had a wife and family to keep, and for the past month, he had found almost no newspaper work. Here was a chance not to be missed. The price of a special story in the Morning Echo, with a £5 note to add to it. It meant comparative wealth and luxury for a week, and freedom from the worst anxieties for a fortnight. Besides, if he wrote the story well, it might lead to an offer of regular employment. So, he said to the manager, I've already promised myself an uncomfortable night because your murderer's den is obviously not fitted up as a hotel bedroom. But I don't think your waxworks will worry me much. You're not superstitious. Not a bit. But you're a journalist. You must have a strong imagination. Well, the news editors for whom I work have always complained that I haven't any. Yeah. There is one condition I'm afraid I must impose upon you. I must ask you not to smoke. Yes, we had a fire scare down in the murderer's den earlier this evening. I don't know who gave the alarm, but it was a false one. Fortunately, there were very few people down there at the time, or there might have been a panic. And now, if you're ready, we'll go. But Houston followed the manager through half a dozen rooms where attendants were busy shrouding the wax figures. Beyond these rooms was the murderer's den. It was a room of irregular shape with a vaulted roof. By design, an eerie and uncomfortable chamber whose atmosphere invited its visitors to speak in whispers. The waxwork murderers stood on low pedestals. The manager, walking around with Houston, pointed out several of the more interesting of these unholy criminals, and Houston pointed and whispered, "Who's that?" "Oh, I was coming to him. And come and have a good look at him. Well, this is our star boarder, Dr. Bourdette." "Huh? Yes, I think I've heard the name, but I forget in connection with what." "Well, you'd remember better if you were a Frenchman. For some long while, that man was the terror of Paris, yes, as he carried on his work of healing by day and throat cutting by night when the fit was on him. He killed for the sheer devilish pleasure it gave him to kill, and always in the same way, with a razor." "After his last crime, he left a clue behind which set the police upon his track. One clue led to another, and before very long, they knew that they were on the track of the Parisian equivalent of our Jack the Ripper. But when he realized that the police were closing about him, he mysteriously disappeared. And ever since, the police of every civilized country have been looking for him." "Hmm. Yes, well, I don't like him at all. Ooh, what eyes he's got."
"Yes.
This wax figure's a little masterpiece. You find the eyes bite into you? Well, now, that's excellent realism, then. For Bourdette practiced mesmerism and was supposed to mesmerize his victims before dispatching them." "Huh. I thought I saw him move." "Yes. You'll have more than one optical illusion before the night's out, I expect. You shan't be locked in. You can come upstairs when you've had enough of it." "Well, good night, Mr. Houston." "Good night. I'll see you in the morning." The manager left, and Houston got ready for the night. He wheeled the armchair a little way down the central gangway and deliberately turned it so that its back was toward the effigy of Dr. Bourdette. For some undefined reason, he liked Dr. Bourdette a great deal less than his companion. Busying himself with arranging the chair, he was almost lighthearted. But when the attendant's footfalls had died away and a deep hush stole over the chamber, he realized that he had no slight ordeal before him. The dim, unwavering light fell on the rows of figures, which were so uncannily like human beings that the silence and the stillness seemed unnatural and even ghastly. The eyes of Dr. Bourdette's effigy haunted and tormented him, and he itched with a desire to turn and look. At last he could stand it no longer and quickly looked behind him. Among the many figures standing in the stiff, unnatural poses, the effigy of the dreadful little doctor stood out with a queer prominence. He thought this was very cowardly and very absurd. They were only waxworks, and they couldn't move. Let him hold that thought, and all would be well. But then, why all that silent unrest about him? A subtle something in the air which didn't quite break the silence and happened whichever way he looked, just beyond the boundaries of his vision. Suddenly, he heard somebody breathing. He swung around quickly to encounter the mild but baleful stare of Dr. Bourdette. No change.
Oh, this was a little too much. It was bad enough that the waxwork effigies of murderers should move when they weren't being watched, but it was intolerable that they should breathe. Somebody was breathing. Or was it his own breath, which sounded to him as if it came from a distance? He sat rigid, listening and straining, until he exhaled with a long sigh. His own breath, after all, or if not, something had divined that he was listening and had at that moment ceased breathing. Now, this would not do. This distinctly would not do. He must clutch at something, gripped with his mind upon something which belonged essentially to the workaday world, to the daylight London streets. He was Raymond Hewson, an unsuccessful journalist, a living and breathing man. And these figures grouped around him were only dummies, so they could neither move nor whisper. Still, the gaze of Dr. Burdett urged, challenged, and finally compelled him to turn. Hewson half turned and then swung his chair so as to bring him face to face with those dreadful hypnotic eyes. Hewson's own eyes were dilated and his mouth lifted at the corners in a snarl. And then Hewson spoke and woke 100 sinister echoes. You moved, blast you! Yes, you did, I saw you! And then he sat quite still, staring straight before him, like a man found frozen in the Arctic snows. Dr. Burdett's movements were leisurely. He stepped off his pedestal with the mincing care of a lady alighting from a bus. He stepped off the platform and sat down on the edge facing Hewson. And then he nodded and smiled and he said, good evening. He spoke in perfect English with only a trace of foreign accent. I need hardly tell you that not until I overheard the conversation between you and the worthy manager of this establishment did I suspect that I should have the pleasure of a companion here for the night. Now, you cannot move or speak without my bidding, but you can hear me perfectly well. Now, something tells me that you are, shall I say, nervous. My dear sir, have no illusions. I am not one of these contemptible effigies miraculously come to life. I am Dr. Burdett himself. Let me explain. Circumstances with which I need not fatigue you have made it desirable that I should live in England. I was close to this building this evening when I saw a policeman regarding me a bit too curiously. So I mingled with the crowd and I came in here, and an inspiration showed me a certain means of escape. I raised the cry of fire, and when all the fools had rushed up the stairs, I stripped my effigy of the caped coat which you behold me wearing. I donned it, I hid my effigy under the platform at the back, and I took its place on the pedestal. I own that I have spent a very fatiguing evening, but fortunately I was not always being watched and had opportunities to draw an occasional deep breath and ease the rigidity of my pose. Oh, one small boy screamed and exclaimed that he saw me moving. I understood that he was to be whipped and put straight to bed on his return home, and I can only hope that the threat has been executed to the letter. I am obliged to the chance which brought us together tonight, and perhaps it would seem ungrateful to complain. From motives of personal safety, my activities have been somewhat curtailed of late years, and I am glad of this opportunity of gratifying my somewhat unusual whim. But you have a skinny neck, sir, if you will overlook a personal remark. I should never have selected you from choice. I like men with thick necks, thick red necks. This, which I have in my hand, is a little French razor. They're not much used in England, but perhaps you know them. Yes, one stops them on wood. The blade, you will observe, is very narrow. They do not cut very deep, but deep enough. In just one little moment, you will see for yourself. Now, my friend, you will have the goodness to raise your chin a little. Thank you. A little more. Just a little more. Ah, thank you. Merci, monsieur. Ah, merci. Merci.
In the morning, the sunrise began to mingle with subdued light from the electric bulbs. And this mingled illumination added a certain ghastliness to a scene which needed no additional touch of horror. The waxwork figures stood apathetically in their places. In their midst, on the center gangway, Fuchsin sat still, leaning far back in his armchair. His chin was up-tilted, as if he were waiting to receive attention from a barber. And although there was not a scratch upon his throat, nor anywhere on his body, he was cold and dead. His previous employers were wrong in having him credited with no imagination. Dr. Bourdette, on his pedestal, watched the dead man unemotionally. He didn't move, nor had he moved. After all, how could he? He was only a waxwork.
That was Nelson Olmsted and the story The Waxwork by A.M. Burridge.
And the narrative I want to bring you now is about a man whose great fear was the last reaction of his life. It's entitled The Man and the Snake. Stretched at ease upon a sofa in gown and slippers, Harker Brayton smiled as he read from Morrister's Marvels of Science. It was an ancient book with its archaic English, which stated, "It is a veritable report and attested of so many that there be now of wise and learned none to gainsay it, that ye serpent, his eye, hath a magnetic property, that whoso falleth into its suasion is drawn forwards in despite of his will and perisheth miserable by ye creature his bite." Brayton smiled again as he thought, "The only marvel in the matter is that the wise and learned in Morrister's day should have believed that snakes could hypnotize their human victims." And a train of reflection followed, for Brayton was a man of thought, and he unconsciously lowered his book without altering the direction of his eyes. As soon as the volume had gone below the line of sight, something in an obscure corner of the room recalled his attention to his surroundings. What he saw, in the shadow under his bed, was two small points of light, apparently about an inch apart. They might have been reflections of the gas jet above him in metal nail heads. He gave them but little thought and resumed his reading. A moment later, something, some impulse which it didn't occur to him to analyze, impelled him to lower the book again and look for what he saw before. The points of light were still there. They seemed to have become brighter than before, shining with a greenish luster that he had not at first observed. He thought, too, that they might have moved a trifle, were somewhat nearer. They were still too much in the shadow, however, to reveal their nature and origin to an indolent attention. And again he resumed his reading. Suddenly, something in the text suggested a thought that made him start and drop the book for the third time to the side of the sofa, where, escaping from his hand, it fell sprawling to the floor, back upward. Brayton, half risen, was staring intently into the obscurity beneath the bed, where the points of light shone with, it seemed to him, an added fire. His attention was now fully aroused, his gaze eager and imperative. It disclosed, almost directly under the footrail of the bed, the coils of a large serpent. The points of light were its eyes. Its horrible head, thrust flatly forth from the innermost coil and resting upon the outermost, was directed straight toward him, the definition of the wide, brutal jaw and the idiot-like forehead serving to show the direction of its malevolent gaze. The eyes were no longer merely luminous points. They looked into his own with a meaning, a malign significance. A snake in a bedroom of a modern city dwelling of a better sort is happily not so common a phenomenon as to make explanation altogether needless. Harker Brayton, a bachelor of 35, returning to San Francisco from all manner of remote and unfamiliar countries, had gladly accepted the hospitality of his friend, Dr. Druring, the distinguished scientist. Dr. Druring's house, a large, old-fashioned one in what is now an obscure quarter of the city, had an outer and visible aspect of proud reserve. It plainly would not associate with the contiguous elements of its altered environment and appeared to have developed some of the eccentricities which come of isolation. One of these was a wing, which was a combination of laboratory, menagerie, and museum. It was here that the doctor indulged the scientific side of his nature in the study of reptiles. He loved nature's vulgarians and described himself as the Zola of zoology. His wife and daughters, not having the advantage to share his enlightened curiosity regarding the works and ways of our ill-starred fellow creatures, were with needless austerity excluded from what he called the snakery. Architecturally, and in point of furnishing, the snakery had a severe simplicity befitting the humble circumstances of its occupants, many of whom, indeed, could not safely have been entrusted with the liberty that is necessary to the full enjoyment of luxury. For they had the troublesome peculiarity of being alive. In their own apartments, however, they were under as little personal restraint as was compatible with their protection from the baneful habit of swallowing one another. And as Brayton had thoughtfully been appraised, it was more than a tradition that some of them had at divers times been found in parts of the premises where it would have embarrassed them to explain their presence. Despite the snakery and its uncanny associations, to which indeed he gave little attention, Brayton found life at the Druring Mansion very much to his mind. Beyond a smart shock of surprise and a shudder of mere loathing, Mr. Brayton was not greatly affected by the sight of a huge snake under his bed. His first thought was to ring the call bell and bring a servant. But although the bell cord dangled within easy reach, he made no movement toward it. It had occurred to his mind that the act might subject him to the suspicion of fear, which he certainly didn't feel. He was more keenly conscious of the incongruous nature of the situation than affected by its peril. It was revolting, but absurd. The reptile was of a species with which Brayton was unfamiliar. Its length he could only conjecture. The body at the largest visible part seemed about as thick as his forearm. In what way was it dangerous, if in any way? Was it venomous? Was it a constrictor? He didn't know. Brayton rose to his feet and prepared to back softly away from the snake without disturbing it if possible, and through the door. Should the monster follow, a rack of murderous oriental weapons hung in the wall from which he would snatch one to suit the occasion. Brayton lifted his right foot free of the floor to step backward. That moment, he felt a strong aversion to doing so. He lifted the foot a little higher by slightly bending the knee and thrust it sharply to the floor an inch in front of the other. He couldn't think how that occurred. A trial with the left foot had the same result. It was again in advance of the right. His hand was grasping the back of a chair. The arm was straight, reaching somewhat backward. One might have said he was reluctant to lose his hold. The snake's malignant head was still thrust from the inner coil as before, the neck level. It hadn't moved, but its eyes were now electric sparks radiating an infinity of luminous needles. Brayton had an ashy pallor. Again, he took a step forward, and another, causing his hand to knock the chair over with a crash. The man groaned. The snake made neither sound nor motion, but its eyes were two dazzling suns. The reptile itself was wholly concealed by them. They gave off enlarging rings of rich and vivid colors, which at their greatest expansion successively vanished like soap bubbles. They seemed to approach his very face and again were an immeasurable distance away. He heard somewhere the continued throbbing of a great drum, with desultory bursts of far music, inconceivably sweet, like the tones of an aeolian harp. He knew it was the sunrise melody of Memnon's statue, as though he stood in the Nile-side reeds, hearing with exalted sense that immortal anthem through the silence of the century. Music ceased. Rather, it became, by insensible degrees, the distant roll of a retreating thunderstorm. A landscape glittering with sun and rain stretched before him, arched with a vivid rainbow, framing in its giant curve 100 visible cities. In the middle distance, a vast serpent, wearing a crown, reared its head out of its voluminous convolutions and looked at him with his dead mother's eyes. Suddenly, this enchanting landscape vanished into blank. Something struck him a hard blow upon the face and breast. He had fallen on the floor. The blood ran from his broken nose and his bruised lips. For a moment, he was dazed and then stunned and lay with closed eyes, his face against the floor. In a few moments, he had recovered and then realized that his fall, by withdrawing his eyes, had broken the spell which held him. He felt that now, by keeping his gaze averted, he would be able to retreat. But the thought of the serpent within a few feet of his head, yet unseen, perhaps in the very act of springing upon him and throwing its coils around his throat, was too horrible. He lifted his head, stared again into those baleful eyes, and was again in bondage. What ensued was a fearful scene. The man, prone upon the floor, within a yard of his enemy, raised the upper part of his body upon his elbows, his head thrown back, his legs extended to their full length. His face was white between its gouts of blood. His eyes were strained open to their uttermost expansion. There was froth upon his lips. It dropped off in flakes. Strong convulsions ran through his body, making almost serpentine undulations. He bent himself at the waist, shifting his legs from side to side, and every movement left him a little nearer to the snake. He thrust his hands forward to brace himself back, yet constantly he advanced upon his elbows. Dr. Druring and his wife were at this moment in the library.
Their conversation was interrupted by a mighty cry which rang through the silent house like the voice of a demon shouting in a tomb. Again and yet again it sounded with terrible distinctness. They sprang to their feet, the man confused, the lady pale and speechless with fright. Almost before the echoes of the last cry had died away, the doctor was out of the room, springing up the staircase two steps at a time. In the corridor in front of Brayton's chamber, he met some servants who had come from the upper floor. Together, they rushed at the door without knocking. It was unfastened and gave way. Brayton lay upon his stomach on the floor, dead. His head and arms were partly concealed under the foot rail of the bed. They pulled the body away, turning it upon the back. The face was daubed with blood and froth. The eyes were wide open, staring, a dreadful sight. Well, he died in a fit, said the scientist, bending his knee and placing his hand upon the heart. And while in that position, he happened to glance under the bed. Well, good Lord, how did this thing get in here? And he reached under the bed, pulled out the snake, and flung it, still coiled, to the center of the room, where it slid across the polished floor till stopped by the wall, where it lay without motion. It was a stuffed snake. Its eyes were two shoe buttons.
You can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it?
Sleep No More, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 9th of January, 1957, on NBC. And so closes this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for tuning in.